Chapter 39, A Debt Incurred. It happened the night I was fired from Update. I wasn't a compulsive gambler at the time, but within 24 hours I would be. I was feeling low after the program ended, while my friends waved at the studio audience and held up little pictures for people they knew were watching TV. Adam Egott and I raced down the New Jersey Turnpike, and it was black, except for the stars in the sky and the eyes of the deer on the highway side. We hit Atlantic City at dawn. The casino sat square in the center of the squalid streets, streets lined with boarded-up houses and stores with signs that read, "We pay cash for gold fillings." And the dangerous poor, with nothing to lose but their lousy, stinking, hopeless lives, and nothing of value but the gold in their teeth. It was Sunday morning, and instead of a church, Adam Egott and I were checking into the Devil's House, the Tropicana Casino and Resort. Gambling addiction is a disease for sure, but it's the only disease that can make you very wealthy. Osteoarthritis ain't going to make you dime one, friend. Just ask my Aunt Gertrude. However, gambling addiction can also be a fatal disease. When a doctor tells you that you have 6 months to live, he's making an educated guess. When the fat man with the artificial hair tells you the same, he's letting you know a fast truth you can mark on a calendar. The only cure for it is cash, and they won't likely be holding any telethons for you. My friend Sid Youngers once said, "I've been very lucky with gambling. I've never won." And anybody with a gambling problem understands that statement all right. First time I was ever in a casino, I was unlucky. I won. And I won big. Back in those days, Adam Egott drank. And he drank like a man. I don't know if he drank to remember or to forget, but boy, could he drink. We ordered two shots of Wild Turkey 101 and told the bartender to leave the bottle be. The bartender was rightly impressed. After we'd emptied the bottle, I hit the blackjack tables to bet my $5 a hand, and Adam Egott wandered onto the boardwalk, stumbling and muttering and telling anybody who would listen how he deserved much more than he had. The next time I saw him, my $300 bankroll was down to 180. "I met a gypsy," Adam Egott slurred. "What?" I asked, eager to get my next bet down. "I went to one of those fortune tellers to get my palm read." "I never figured you for one to believe in that horse shit." "I did it as a lark, as a gag. But here's the thing. The old woman, the gypsy, she looked at my palm and her face darkened, and she looked up at me with her black gypsy eyes, and my laugh got caught in my throat, and I wish I'd never had the idea for the lark, for the gag. She told me I was going to die, Norm. She told me I was going to die tonight." "Well, then how come I booked two rooms?" I asked. And I laughed hard at my fine joke. And so did the dealer. But Adam Egott did not. He continued with a straight face. "She wants $100, and she'll give me a packet with some powder in it that I'm supposed to put under my pillow. If I do that, I won't die tonight." "Well, can't you see she's making the whole thing up, Adam Egott? You'll be fine." "That's what I thought. But when I went to bed, I couldn't sleep. Every time I closed my eyes, I saw the old gypsy's face and heard her words. I'm scared, Norm. You have to lend me $100. "I'm losing money at this blackjack table, Adam Egott, and I won't indulge your silly superstitions. If you want $100, why don't you just jerk off 7 punks?
"I told you about that in confidence," he said.
"You did?"
"Yes, of course."
"Oh, I thought everybody knew you jerked off punks underneath the Queensboro Bridge for $15 a man."
"Don't say that anymore."
"Okay, sorry. I didn't know you told me in confidence.
Don't you remember I was crying when I told you?"
"Sure I do, but I thought that's what you fellows do."
"What do you mean, you fellows? I'm not gay," he said.
I stood corrected. "I'll give you $12 for one," said the dealer, "but not a penny more." Adam Egott looked at the dealer, and he appeared hurt. "Look, fellow, I don't do that stuff anymore. That was before, and this is now. And now I'm Norm's assistant. That's my job. And I need an advance. $100 advance. As I was talking to Adam Egott, I'd lost another $35, and I got angry. Get away from me. It's still early, and if I end up winning, I'll give you $100 so you can pay the old gypsy. But until then, get out of here. With that, Adam Egott slunk away, whimpering. It put me in mind of a hyena. I changed tables and had a run of good luck. My bankroll was up to $250 now, and I was approaching even. This went on, and time passed, as it always does, since it knows no other way. 1 minute I was up, and the next I was down. When I only had $100 chip left, I took a break and walked around the casino. As I passed a craps table, a patron recognized me. "Hey, you're somebody, aren't you?" a man holding two dice said. "Sure I am," I said. "I'm Norm MacDonald, and I'm on the TV." This got everybody very excited, because they were just a bunch of nobodies who had TVs but were never on them. They insisted I play craps with them. But the problem was I'd never played the game and didn't know any of the rules. But I couldn't let these nobodies know that. "Sure, I'll play. And I'll win, too." The whole table of nobodies cheered, which made me feel good. The truth was that deep down, I felt like I was a nobody, too. Just like them. Behind the craps table stood the pit boss, a handsome man, dressed in the most beautiful suit of clothes I'd ever seen. He was looking the picture of style and class, but I got the feeling that he was a dangerous man, and his beautiful clothes were designed to hide that fact, the way a shiny new violin case can conceal a machine gun. If you don't know the game of craps, here's how it works. As long as the fellow rolling the dice doesn't roll a 7, you stay alive. And when they hit your numbers, you win. And you can have as many as 6 different numbers. The minimum at the table was $25. So I put down my $100 chip to get change, but the man behind the table placed it on the pass line, and I was too embarrassed to correct him. It was all the money I had left. An Asian player rolled 5 or 6 times, and a 6 came up, and the pit boss gave me $120. "Press?" the man behind the table said. I didn't want to look like a know-nothing, so I said, "What do you think?" as if the answer was self-evident. I use that line a lot when I don't know what's going on. The man smiled, and now I had $220 down. From there on in, every one of my wins was automatically pressed. He only asked me that first time. Within 20 minutes, I had money on every number on the board. And within 40 minutes, I had a lot of money on every number. This Asian player, he didn't seem to know how to roll a 7. And my chip denominations had climbed from the original $5 chip to a $1,000 chip. And finally, at about the hour mark, I was playing with the maximum $5,000 chip. The funny thing is, the $5 chip was the very same size as the $5,000 chip. Probably cost the same to make, but it was worth 1,000 times more. I was winning big time now. I began to feel an extraordinary transformation taking place deep within me, one that mirrored my chip's transformation, for I felt myself double in value and then redouble and press to the maximum. I was the exact same size physically, and yet I was worth much more, 1,000 times more. And that lingering suspicion that I might be a nobody was long gone. The Asian player rolled for 20 more minutes, and finally he rolled a 7 and the run was over. Everyone cheered, and I had $118,000 in chips. I colored up, threw a $50 tip on the table, and left in perfect calm and elation, big as God inside, blessed on this Sunday in the unlikeliest of places. I walked onto the boardwalk, my heart and pockets full. The people around me all looked small, and I knew that I was once like them, but now I was different. Same on the outside, maybe, but 1,000 times as bright, 1,000 times as powerful, 1,000 times what they were. I saw the blackjack dealer I had first sat with and lost $120 to. "Remember me?" I asked. "Sure, I remember you," the dealer said, and I noticed he was zipping up his trousers. "Your friend's over there, and he's $12 richer." I walked over and saw Adam Egan, and he was on a bench weeping. When he saw me, he fell to the ground and clutched at my ankles. "Norm, please, I need you to punch me in the face," he said. "Don't be ashamed, Adam Egan," I said. "A man must do what he can to make a living in this world, and sometimes life can be a hard, hard coin." "No, I need you to punch me in the face so I can sell my gold fillings. It's nearly midnight, and I am very afraid." "Don't worry," I laughed. "I am blessed by God himself this Sabbath, and you will not die tonight." And as I said that, I carefully counted out $88 worth of chips and tossed them down on the boardwalk, and Adam Egan got on his hands and knees as they clattered around, searching them all out in the dark. And then he kissed my feet and ran to find the old gypsy.
I awoke with a plan. I hesitate to call it my own plan, since it did not exist when I fell asleep the previous evening. It was as if another man had spent months conniving and creating the plan, and then had come to me as I slept and staged it whole in my mind. For 3 weeks now, an enfeebling depression has fastened me to my bed. The house painter has been rejected by every publishing house in the city. I'd expected a bidding war, but I hadn't even received an opening salvo. When the rejection letters first began appearing in my mailbox, I was amused, and I felt sorry for each poor chap who had passed on my masterpiece and would certainly one day lose his job over the decision. But as the rejection letters kept coming, despondency fell upon me. Was it possible that the years of transcribing lame anecdotes of marginal celebrities had atrophied my skills to the point where my real writing was unpublishable? My first anxiety came with the silence of Julie Grau. I thought perhaps she hadn't received the manuscript, so I put another in the mail, and a week later sat in shock over a cup of coffee while I read an unsigned form letter from Random House. I rang Julie up. "Oh, Terence, how lovely of you to call. What's wrong with it?" "Your novel? Well, to tell you the truth, I simply haven't had the time to read it. I just got back from..." "What's wrong with it?" A long silence followed. "There's nothing wrong with it, Terence. It's really quite charming. Have you considered self-publishing?" A much longer silence followed. "Terence, how is the Norm Macdonald book coming along?" I threw the phone through my window. And that is what put me in my bed and kept me there, eating Haagen-Dazs and Kit Kats, Milky Ways and Twix, drinking Mexican Cokes, watching Bewitched, and falling asleep and waking up and falling asleep again. But this morning, I awoke with the plan. I bounced to the floor, showered, shaved, and put on my best shirt. I carefully read my novel as if I had never written it. I had to be sure. Absolutely sure. I have just finished the last line, and I am as certain as ever. It is pitch perfect. And now I put a fresh page in the old Underwood and begin composing another work. Although the task of writing has always been a laborious process for me, there is no tedium this time. The words come easy and very fast. Perhaps I have found a genre perfectly suited to my skills. The suicide note.